Welcome to Who's Talking. I'm D.G. Martin, and joining me recently in Raleigh were authors John Grisham and John Hart to launch Hart's new book, The Hush, and to raise funds to support the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Listen now to the second hour of that program.
Okay, can I tell a war story?
Yes.
This is my only connection to dinosaurs, and it's very tenuous. 25 years ago, this year, both the movies of The Firm and The Pelican Brief came out, 1983. The Firm came out in the summer of 83. Pelican Brief came out in December of 93. That's right, 25 years ago. And so they're big movies, big cast, big box office. It was a heady time for us. About that time, Michael Crichton finished Jurassic Park. I never met Michael, but we had a good thing going because Michael, when he sold Jurassic Park, he set the record for film rights from a novel that I had set with Pelican Brief, okay?
He broke your record.
He broke my record, okay? And so then the next year I came out with a client and there was a new record, okay? So then Michael came out with his next book and he supposedly told his agent, I want one more dollar than Grisham, okay? This went on for about five books. We were back and forth. Our agents were, both of us were setting records. This is back when Hollywood paid big money for film rights. They don't do it now. Hollywood does not do it now. But this is back in the glory days. And I never met Michael Crichton, but we made a bunch of money off each other, okay?
And then he had to go and die.
Yeah, he died far too young. And nobody made as much money as Crichton because, no writer, because he did Jurassic Park. He also did ER, he did television shows. I mean, he was printing money 25 years ago. He made tons of money.
I think it's really interesting that a lot of folks here would say, we had John Grisham talk about being jealous of another author.
I would say jealous.
I was never jealous. I love the story. He married like five women, and his buddy Steve Martin said, haven't you heard of premarital sex? Cheap shot. He's dead. Poor guy's dead.
Both you all practiced law before you became authors. Any regrets?
About which part?
Becoming an author? About practicing law, yeah.
Why don't you take that one, John?
I did it for 10 years. You did it for...
I was brief. Two and a half years, maybe. Look, here's what I got from the law. Motive matters in the kind of books we write. And I don't think that it's possible to write compelling suspense novels, crime novels, whatever you wish to call them, without understanding what makes people do bad things. And what I learned from my time in criminal defense work is that there are no criminal masterminds. It's usually people making rash decisions for base reasons without considering the repercussions. So I came to understand a lot about what leads people to do bad things from having dealt with them. But I think even more significantly, learning about the tremendous power of the ripple effect that comes from some violent act and how it stretches beyond anyone's ability to predict, family members, loved ones, communities. It's crazy, and this shows up in pretty much all of my books. So I never regret the experience. I think I learned a lot from it. There's no part of me that wants to go back to it, but I'm glad I did it. I really am.
I don't think I would ever have written the first book if I'd not been a lawyer. Writing was not something I dreamed about as a child. I didn't study it as a student. It came later in life. It happened one day, one moment, when I was in a courtroom. And I witnessed a trial that had a profound impact on me, this terrible trial involving a young girl who had been abused. And I became obsessed with this courtroom drama as seen through the eyes of a young idealistic attorney in a small southern town, pretty much autobiographical, in a big trial, and you know, I had this great courtroom drama, and I had never written anything before that, and that became A Time to Kill. It took 3 years to write the book. The book was a total flop. It didn't sell. And I told my wife, I said, I'm going to do this one more time. It was a secret little hobby that no one knew about but her, and because she was reading my stuff. And I said, I'm going to write one more book. And if this doesn't work, you can forget this little secret hobby, and I'm going to, you know, spend my time being a lawyer and, you know, pursuing something else. But I've often wondered, if I had not been a lawyer and been in that courtroom and seen this incredibly dramatic, tragic scene, if I would have ever written a book. And I don't think so. So I didn't have 10 years of productive law practice, and I couldn't wait to quit. I couldn't wait to get out of it. It was not a whole lot of fun, but it gave me something that changed my life.
Do you find that when you talk to lawyers who love your books, that they're happy with their work?
Those who read the books and those who don't. I mean, I know a lot of lawyers, and there are not many happy ones. It's true. Most of your small town guys are squeezed because of competition, and there are a lot of lawyers, a lot of small town guys who it's tough to make a decent living. Your big firm guys make the money, but they put in the hours, and the lifestyle is not that appealing. There aren't many guys in the middle who or ladies in the middle who practice law and, you know, really, really enjoy it. I haven't met too many people.
It's so funny to me because you described with passion your writing today of this courtroom scene that obviously was fun for you to write, hard but fun for you to write, and you felt an identification with the characters.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a part of you that is still practicing law.
Well, only to the extent that it helps me almost every day read cases, read stories, read about issues, and get ideas for books. John and I can read, we've talked about this, we're both lawyers. We can read a book about the law, a trial, a courtroom drama, whatever, and within 10 pages, we know if the writer is a lawyer. There's a level of authenticity you can't fake, okay? And because I did it for years in courtrooms, it's second nature for me. But it's very frustrating to read a book about a courtroom drama or whatever that's written by somebody who really does not know what they're writing about. And so I'm blessed with that. And I'm able to take that knowledge and that experience from a long time ago, and I've been able to do this for a long time, and write stories about the law. We are fascinated as a culture, as a society, with stories about the law and lawyers, and we have an insatiable appetite for stories about lawyers. And look at the television show. I mean, look at the movie, whatever. We look at what we sell. This is our culture. It's our DNA. We love stories about lawyers, I think it's because we, as a people, we have so many rights, more so than anybody else in the world, and most of those rights are real, but some of those rights are sort of perceived. And if somebody messes with our rights, we're pissed off. Okay, we're gonna do something about it. If you mess with one of our rights, as Americans, we're gonna do something about it. If we can, we're gonna take action.
I think it's where the rubber meets the road. I mean, it's why people loved ER and they loved LA Law. You know, any of these dramas where the rubber meets the road, meaning the things that really matter are exposed and they're raw and the stakes are high, and people are either going to win or they're going to lose and lives are going to be shattered or saved. And you see it in the courtroom, you see it in the emergency room, and there is this inherent drama that everyone understands in a fundamental way, because we can imagine ourselves being there. You know, if it were my life on the line, if I were wrongly accused, or if I were going to lose my family farm, or whatever it was, I mean, that happens in the courtrooms. I mean, that's rich soil for you, I think. I mean, and you mine it very, very well. That's a compliment.
He doesn't know what to say when he's got a case.
It's the first one ever.
John Grisham, John Hart, and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin, and we are listening to authors John Grisham and John Hart.
I want you guys, this is a sensitive topic, and if you don't want to talk about it, it's fine, but you guys have a lot of connections to North Carolina, both of you. But you're proud residents of Charlottesville, or the area around Charlottesville. So what have you learned about the advantages of being in Virginia that could be helpful to us in making North Carolina a better place?
I'm not answering that.
I'll take this.
Or are you both ambassadors to this poor place in Virginia and bringing North Carolina values to Virginia?
Well, I'll take this one because
I'll take the fifth.
I have a very specific answer. I actually have a very specific answer. That's why I moved to Charlottesville, and it wasn't to stalk you, John. I'm glad to know you, but that wasn't the reason. And look, this probably isn't why these folks came here, but North Carolina has experienced this phenomenal growth. I mean, the economy here has just been unbelievable. But I'm a land lover. I mean, I like farmland. I like open spaces. I wanted to raise my children in that environment, but I didn't want to be 50 minutes outside of a major city. I wanted to be able to have, you know, a large farm where I could be in town in a matter of minutes instead of driving 30 miles down the interstate. And if I would change anything about North Carolina, I would dial back some of the sprawl that has eaten up all the open spaces between our great cities. I mean, it really is my passion. I mean, land conservation is what I care about, and it just kills me. And our population is going to double in the next 15 or 20 years, and it's only going to get worse. I think steps need to be taken. I picked Albemarle County because 24% of the land already is protected permanently. It can never be developed. 24%, that is a huge number, and it's getting bigger every year. I wish we did more of that in North Carolina. That's why I'm in Virginia.
But at the same time, most areas of Virginia do not have the conservation efforts we have in Albemarle County.
Then I should say that's why I'm in Albemarle County.
Yeah, if you look at Northern Virginia, look at the sprawl. I mean, it's like the rest of America.
Yeah, I know. But
we do a better job, I think, of protecting our areas.
Yeah,
and it's beautiful. So it's a great place to live.
When I was an aspiring writer, I always was fairly attuned to places that writers chose to live, writers that could live anywhere that were writing full time. And we have places like this here. I mean, Asheville is a big draw, Chapel Hill.
Hillsboro.
Charleston comes to mind, Charlottesville. I mean, these towns spoke to me in a fundamental way because if writers, you know, they're probably going to be like me. If they could live anywhere, there's got to be a reason that they're concentrating in these areas. Again, I would look at what's happening in those places and try to mimic it. But look, life's complicated. I get it. You know, people.
I want you to, before we quit, I want you to talk. Both of you have wonderful families that you gain sustenance from and are proud of. And your wife and daughter are here. Your wife is sick, but her mother is here to represent your
mom.
Mom is here.
Both moms.
Your sister's here. Your mom?
No, both John.
John, talk a little bit about your family and to what extent that family's culture is a part of your work.
Well, I mean, look, I love my family too much to speak about them, so frankly, that's a joke, folks. Look, I think there are a few fundamental glues that tie us all together, whether we're writers, lawyers, accountants, or anything else, and family is first and foremost the big one. I mean, and then it's community and faith and these other things. I always bring family elements into my books because, I've been called many things as a writer. I've been called a writer of thrillers, Southern Gothic, mystery, suspense. Family drama is one of my favorites, and it sounds disingenuous, but pretty much everything I've written has this deep backstory of family, and there's a reason for that. We all have them, whether they're good, bad, indifferent, or even absent. Those truths ring strongly for the readers. I mean, if it's a terrible family and we came from a good one, that hurt is very real. If we came from a terrible family ourselves, that resonance is very real. So I think family is very important to storytelling. So I don't want to talk about my family specifically, except to say that they're lovely and they've been nurturing and they've made me the person that I am. And in fact, I honestly would not have this career had my family not been so supportive. But I'm endlessly fascinated with family because a wrong word can leave a wound that lasts for a decade, even if it's unintentional. And, you know, a kind act can be taken for granted when it never should be in some other circumstances. So family is just fascinating to me, and I'm blessed to have a great one.
Right. John, your whole front row is your family.
Oh, I never talk about my family. We're never sure who's on parole and who's not. That's the extended family, right? Let me score some points here, okay? My wife was born in Raleigh at Rex Hospital, and 2 years ago, our first grandchild was born at Rex. And my daughter lives about 5 minutes away. My wife went to UNC. She's a Tar Heel. My daughter's a Tar Heel. My daughter married a Tar Heel. She gave birth to a Tar Heel. And she's now expecting another Tar Heel. And so we got Tar Heels all over the family. My wife has kin folks in the area. Her family is, her father's family is from Clayton. Her mother was from Garner, Fuquay, Verena, Apex, out of those areas. And we, in our early years of marriage, we had no money. We would drive to from Memphis to Clayton, North Carolina, and pile in with her grandmother for a week, who would do nothing but cook for us. And we'd read on the porches, and so, fine lady. So I have some very deep roots here.
We thank both families for sharing these two great guys with us. And it's time for us to open, I know you're tired of my questions, and this banter that they've had with each other. So we'll give you all a chance. And I think we got someone with a microphone. Or am I too early?
Come on both sides.
Both sides. If you'd like to ask a question.
Or just stand up and yell, it doesn't matter. We'll repeat the question. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
What do you read?
Who do we read? Good, John. Well, he doesn't read, I'm sorry. What are you reading?
I suffer from a serious affliction for a writer. I call it voice creep, which means if I'm reading something that's similar to the field I'm working in, I start to internalize that author's voice, bastardize it, and then ruin what I'm trying to do. And so,
me too. No, that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
When I'm writing fiction, I don't read fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you want to read great writers, and you catch yourself imitating subconsciously a great writer, and writing stuff that you wouldn't write.
How have we not talked about this yet? I mean, I thought I was alone in this. It's a real risk. I mean, if you read 7 books while you're writing your own, you can have 7 voices by the time you finish your novel, so it's a real problem. I don't know what your solution is. When I'm working, I read a lot of historical fiction, science fiction. I know you're not going to go there. Nonfiction, but anything that is good and bears no relation to what I'm trying to do.
I'm writing a novel now, and I've got 10 books, all nonfiction, that relate to the subject matter, to relate to the story, the background, and some of it's legal stuff, some of it's history, and I tend to read nonfiction this time of the year. In the summertime, we go to the beach, I'll take 3 or 4 novels, and I like to read, we always read Pat Conroy.
Yeah.
Love Pat's books. Yeah. I read the other lawyer writers to check the competition. I'll read all the books by, read a bunch of books by various writers, mystery writers. One summer I spent the whole time reading Mark Twain. I'm all over the map, so I have a lot of favorites. Next, yes, sir. Stand up. Yale.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you for that. So the question is, as I was writing The Last Child, which was, it's been about almost 10 years, at what point did I think I might want to write The Hush? Is that the question? Not until fairly recently. John and I share this. I don't know that you've written one sequel, right?
Yep.
Sycamore Row. I've written one. It's not always a winning proposition to go back to a successful novel because you could screw it up and you could ruin people's thoughts about you as the author or the characters that you labored so hard to make meaningful. So I did it with some trepidation and a lot of careful consideration. And literally for me, it was just something that I felt I needed to do because I love those boys. I wanted to see the kind of young men they had become. And it was really that simple. If someone tells you later in the evening that it's because I didn't have an idea for a 6th book, don't believe them.
John Grisham, John Hart, and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and we are listening to authors John Grisham and John Hart.
Good question.
Oh, that's nice.
It's one of those 3-part questions. I hate 2-part questions because I always forget the first part by the time you get through the second part. But the first part was, what was it? Jay Braganza was the third part. Jay Braganza in Time to Kill was a very autobiographical character. I'm not sure. The name came from a case I had early on, a guy named Jake Brick. And I don't know why I kept that and made it Jake Braganza. I don't know. My goal back then was to write a book out of Ford County, this my little fictional world where I love to write, and write Time to Kill, then write a legal thriller, go back to Ford County, and back and forth and back and forth. And that was my brilliant plan 30 years ago. And I had no idea what I was doing. And Time to Kill came out in 89. It sold 5,000 copies. The Firm came out in 91 and sold about 5 million. So I was convinced to stick with the legal thrillers for a while. And it took a long time to go back to Ford County of 20 years with Sycamore Row. Honestly, I didn't have a story. I didn't have a story for Jake. And I always wanted to go back there. And my wife was a little bit reluctant for me to go back there. When I wrote A Time to Kill, I was that young lawyer. I was 30 years old, you know, living that life and speaking through that voice. And I worried, and she worried about being able now, 25 years later, when everything has changed in my world, to be able to go back and capture that voice. That's still something I think about when I think about a story from Ford County.
So let me ask a follow-up question then. Four-part question.
I can't remember the first two parts.
So four-part question. So are there characters, places that are more meaningful to you than others? I mean, like in a significant way that you really do return to in your thoughts time and again?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. The book I'm writing now takes place in Ford County in 70 years ago.
So is Ford County the repository of these characters? I mean, that's kind of your space.
Most of them. I mean, most of my legal thrillers can take place anywhere. Rooster Bar was Washington, D.C. The Whistler was Northern Florida. Gray Mountain was West Virginia, or Virginia. I mean, the Broker took place in Bologna, Italy. I can take these stories all over the world. The Firm was Memphis. The first few books were Memphis because I lived there, or close to it, and it's the only place I've ever been. I didn't know any other big cities, so I put them all in Memphis. I can take a legal thriller. I've done Washington several times, Chicago. Those places, that's not where I'm from, okay?
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
But rural Mississippi is where I'm from. And mm-hmm. Ford County is where I'm from. And there are just a lot of stories that I would like to tell from there. At the same time, Jake, I can't go back to Jake all the time because Jake can only have so many momentous trials in a career in a small town in Mississippi, so I have to watch that. The other two parts I forgot about. Oh, you mentioned the bookstores. I did a book tour last year for the first time in 20 years, and I went to 13 towns, cities, and signed books and had a great time, did podcasts with local authors, and six of them were in North Carolina, and it was really rewarding. Great Quail Ridge is a great bookstore. Scuppernong in Greensboro, my favorite name for a bookstore, Scuppernong. Malaprops in Asheville. We did Park Road in Charlotte. Several others. Anyway, it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed the book tour. Enjoyed the bookstores in North Carolina.
If you wanted more, the great conversation that you all had at Park Road Books is on the web. And they were not interrupted by a moderator. So you were much better at Park Road. But a lot of the things that we didn't cover as well in this conversation are on. You all did a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you, DG.
Yes, ma'am.
What books are available out in the audience?
What books are available out there?
Because I think they're all the ones you wanted to make sure everybody.
They're all John Hart's on sale.
Now, there are some John Grisham
books,
too.
For half price. He can't give them away, okay? He's just trying to... Yes, sir. Stand up.
How are you? Can you hear me? Okay,
yes,
there
ma'am.
We go. So I'm a true crime author. I'm a crime journalist for 28 years. And my question is, how do you transition from nonfiction to fiction? Any advice?
Oh, wow. I don't know anything
about
nonfiction.
I have the stories. I just have to figure out how to get there.
Yeah, that sounds like a job for the innocent man.
I transitioned from fiction to nonfiction one time with The Innocent Man, and it was, it's a story I love. It all goes back to story, okay? It was not easy. I'm not trained as a journalist. I didn't know how to investigate witnesses or verify sources or things. I mean, I was on thin ice the whole time. And it took 18 months of research that I'm much too lazy to do normally, okay? I just don't want to work that hard. I'm not sure how you go from nonfiction to fiction, although, as I said earlier, you can take almost any garden variety murder case, change a few facts, and create an incredible mystery. It just takes the imagination. I think that's what John and I have, and not being in any way boastful, we both have hyperactive imaginations. We can take factual basic scenarios, whatever, and characters, and figure out ways to get them so totally screwed up and in danger, and we can get them out of it, or hopefully. That's what we do. And I think to succeed in with suspense and mystery and crime fiction, you have to have that type of hyperactive imagination.
Great question.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you, you're right close to the microphone.
Tricks of the trade on how to make the reader turn the page?
That's a great question, because John actually has rules on writing writing fiction, and DG has them printed out. She is not a plant, ladies and gentlemen.
I've already changed most of these rules. I mean, so your question is, how do you make the pages turn? That's not one of my rules. It's a goal. I think it goes back to basic suspense, which goes back to danger. You have to have a sympathetic character that people like. Not perfect by any means. Deeply flawed if you want, but not, you know, we don't want the perfect. You don't want the Hollywood ending. And you get that person in a whole lot of trouble. And you figure out ways to get them out.
And, you know, another thing you can do, it's difficult to have action on every page, right? Because then it just becomes kind of an absurdity. A great way to keep a reader hooked is just to pose questions. I mean, not literally like, what if this happened, right? Not questions, but why did this person return home after a five-year absence? You know, what is the cause of this friction between these two people? You know, is she going to leave her husband? I mean, pick a question based on whatever you want to say, whatever story you want to tell. But if the characters mean something to your readers, they're going to want to have those questions answered. So I think John's point is good. You definitely have to put your characters into stake-rich situations where they need to figure out a way to get out, and then you take the journey with them. But when you can't have that in every chapter, I think it's also effective to just present these questions, and they can be subtle or they can be in your face, and if the reader cares enough, they're going to want to have those questions answered. And then of course your next step is to answer the questions. So by the end of the book, you need to resolve all of those things.
Do you ever forget to resolve something?
Not yet. Not the matter has not called me on.
John Grisham, John Hart, and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin, and we are listening to authors John Grisham and John Hart.
First, how you got your first book published?
Okay, I'll go first. So I was a 15-year overnight success story, which means that for a long time, I was the most widely unpublished writer in the South. Two novels that nobody wanted to represent, nobody wanted to publish, no one wanted to read, barring, my forgiving family members, my lovely wife, who actually at that time was just my girlfriend and married me in spite of those manuscripts. There is no magic bullet. I wish that there were. It's a question of honing your craft until you have something worth being published, then putting on your thick skin and sending it out to people that will not care about you as a person. They will violently, unpleasantly tell you how little talent you have. You'll get one-word rejections written back at the top of your own letter. No in big red, circled three times. I've got plenty of those. For me, it was really a question of going through the two failed novels, getting to the third that seemed to have some merit, and then I made a very big rookie mistake. I finished the book, and I wanted that validation. It's so important to the unpublished writer to have someone in the industry say, yes, you are worthy. No, you have not wasted years of your life. So I sent the manuscript out immediately. I literally wrote the end and had it in the mail to agents the next day. Well, everyone that saw it turned it down, and it was for good reason. I was so despondent over all those rejections that I couldn't look at it for about 9 months. I took a new job, a whole new career, a whole new city. I moved to Greensboro. And after 9 months, I finally found the will to pull out that manuscript and look at it with a little more jaded eyes and ask myself, what did they hate about it so much? And I saw every problem that a trained agent or a trained editor saw. I mean, all of the overwriting, the 10 dialogue, the plot holes, all of the things that should have never been sent out. So I spent 3 months taking that mess and making it into something worthy, and the first agent that saw it wanted to represent me. So for me, it was about that perseverance and being willing to never accept a manuscript as good enough until someone who can actually write a check or get me to that place tells me it's good enough. Because we all want to think that the words are sacrosanct as soon as we write them. Those are my words. They cannot be touched. That's the wrong attitude.
Well, this was 1987, before the internet, and back then there were certain, not rules, but guidelines for publishing, getting published, as submissions. And so you would take the first three chapters with a cover letter and send that to agents and publishers. Now you can't even submit to publishers now. Back then you could submit to publishers and at agents. And I had a list of 30 agents and a list of 30 publishers. And I was in the state legislature in Jackson, so I would leave on Monday to go to the state house. And my secretary took the top five agents and top five publishers and fixed up the submission. So I had 10 submissions going to New York, okay? And I would come home Friday from Jackson, go by the office, and there would be a pile of rejections. and her instructions were she would get a submission back from New York, and she would redo the letter, go to the next name on the list, strike it off, and so I always had 10 floating around New York somewhere, and they were all rejected. And I came home one week from Jackson, and we were having dinner. I was talking to Renee, and the kids were very small. This was 1987. Shay, our daughter, was a year old. And I said, I stopped by the office today, and I got a bunch of rejections. And she said, well, I'm sorry. You know, it was kind of a fun hobby. I had a career. I was a lawyer. I was in the legislature. We had a good life. It was a dream, but it was also, you know, this little secret hobby that nobody knew about. And I said, I got 4 or 5 rejections this week. And she said, yeah, well, I'm sorry. And she said, you know, you're sending the first three chapters with your submissions, and those are not the three most compelling chapters in the book. And I said, okay. She said, why don't you pick like chapter 1, chapter 3, and chapter 7? And I said, you mean three chapters at random? She said, yeah. And I said, that's pretty stupid. Who wants to read three chapters at random?
Random
said,
house.
She said, well, you're not doing so good, so hot on your own, okay? And I said, okay, this is a hobby. So I took chapters 1, 3, and 7 and copied those and sent them out Monday morning. And within a week, three of the agents had called. And the first agent who called said, I want to represent you and send me the book. And it was terribly exciting, April of 1987. It took him a year to shop the book around. It was turned down again by everybody in New York for the second round. So I had like 30 rejections from both agents and publishers. And I've kept their letters. I got a file.
I have them too. I have the same file. Yeah.
We always keep the letters.
Love the
we
file. Keep
and so then finally, an editor at a very small house read A Time to Kill and said, I want to buy it.
Let me give another little note of hope, because you sound like an aspiring writer, and I'm guessing. So when I was sending out, they would ask you to send, you know, your letter and your sample chapters and a return envelope with your address on it. So, you know, these people, they're not giving you a damn thing, right? So I'd come home from work, and I'd go to the mailbox, and I'd see my own handwriting on my own letter with my own stamp telling me no. And I wasn't kidding. And literally, they would take my letter and just write no on it, stick it in my envelope, and send it back. This is hard business, okay? And this went on for I don't remember how long, and I'll never forget the day. I came home, it was on a Friday at about 5 o'clock, a few minutes before, and my wife was sitting on the front stoop, and she was waiting for me, which was not a common thing, and she said, you need to pick up the phone and call somebody. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, an agent called 30 minutes ago. He's going to be there for just a few minutes. You got to call him right now. And I was like, oh, God, got to call the agent. So I called this guy. His name was Mickey Choate. He ended up becoming my agent for a long time, but I sat on the stoop for 30 minutes listening to him tell me all that he loved about The King of Lies. And he just said, I love this, and I love that, and I love this, and I love that. And then after 30 minutes of him doing all the talking, he said, so what do you think? And I said, Mickey, I'm just waiting for you to say you want to represent me. To him, it was obvious what he was saying. To me, no. I mean, I was so battered and bruised, I couldn't imagine that anyone wanted to do it. So we had quite a dinner out that night.
I had one agent who I sent the first, third, and seventh chapters to, and he wrote me this really snippy letter. He said, I don't walk into the second act of a Broadway play. I don't walk into the fourth inning of a New York Yankees baseball game. I don't do, you know, don't send me. I said, oh, fine, sorry, you know. Just say no, you know. 2 years later, I sent him a copy of The Firm.
Well, let me hang it.
Got it. To your question, I have no idea how you get published today, because it's all online, and publishers do not take submissions. You have to have an agent. But I still believe, and I tell students or aspiring writers all the time, if what you're writing is good and you're persistent, it's going to get noticed. Because there's so many young, aggressive agents in the business who are looking, they're scouring the internet looking for online journals, magazines, essays, whatever. They're looking for talent, okay? And if your writing is good, somebody's going to notice it. And after several years of submitting and writing hard, if it hasn't been noticed, maybe you need to, you know, take a hard look in the mirror. It may not happen. But there's always hope. It's harder now to get published than ever before. At the same time, publishing needs, we need brand new writers every year. We need literary authors that we don't really read, but we need commercial stars. We need powerhouse writers who can sell books, get people in bookstores, because that benefits all of us. Yep. Publishing needs, desperately right now needs, we're not that old, we're kind of the older guys. We need young 30-year-old female suspense writers who can sell a ton of books. That's what publishing needs, okay? And not just women, but men, whatever, okay? But publishing needs new stars every year. And we try our best to help them. We read books and give blurbs. And why are you standing up over there?
All right, quick question. We're about to the end, so.
Yeah, okay. I didn't know if we'd done something wrong.
No.
Just testing. What is your favorite movies?
Beg your pardon?
Do you have any favorite movies in particular?
Do you like, what are your favorite movies?
My favorite movies?
Other than your own books.
The Sting, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Gone with the Wind. My movies? You know, I've had 9 books adapted to film, and I enjoyed watching 8 of them. I've been very lucky with Hollywood. I'm very, very lucky. The movies have been fun to watch.
I don't get involved in them.
Yeah.
I actually stay away. The last two that were filmed a long time ago, Skipping Christmas and Runaway Jury, we never went to the set to meet everybody. We're just too busy or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I don't get near them. I've tried. I hope they, you know, we try to deal with good directors, with good studios and all that. Back when we did movies, we don't do movies anymore. We can't make a movie. I've been lucky with Hollywood. The movies have been very important to the career. They've sold a lot of books. They're on television somewhere tonight.
Thanks for listening to part two of our program with authors John Grisham and John Hart. This program is available online at chapelboro.com. This is D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.